pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning
with the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading excerpts from When Chapel Hill Was a Village by Cornelia Spencer Love, published in 1976 by the Chapel Hill Historical Society. Franklin Street Shops. The old post office stood about where the downtown one is now, a small wooden building where everybody went to collect their mail. Those in university buildings sent their janitors, carrying large canvas bags. I may not be naming the stores in exact order, or even in chronological coexistence, but this is not important. Near the Presbyterian Church, the old wooden one, which later was burned down, was Abbs, or Abernathy's, bookshop, which in time moved up the block and became the Intimate. Ab made money, in spite of his lax business methods, co-sponsored a unique magazine, Contempo, then sold out and moved to New York, where I heard he did very well, in real estate, or was it investments? He seemed to be a curious mixture of simplicity and shrewdness. Kemp's first record shop was in part of Ab's, and was a very popular place. He also had some beautiful jade that he had collected, but most of this was stolen. Mr. Sorrell had a tiny jewelry and watch repair shop, which you visited often if he was working on your watch, for he never would say when it would be finished. The prime mender of clocks and watches was Mr. Squires, up a long flight of stairs and down a long hall. He also kept bees, and would display a row of bottles containing honeycomb and honey on his windowsill. He offered Mrs. Day a bottle, for which she thanked him, and started to take away with her, until Mr. Squires made clear that it was a sale, not a gift. So she politely gave it back. Ledbetter Pickard was our only stationery shop, long before Hallmark cards were invented. It has enlarged and added counters until you can hardly get from one end of it to the other, but I always found it a very useful shop, with such pleasant young women, in later years, to wait on me. Mr. Ledbetter's mother kept the last student's boarding house that I know of. The first cafeteria was opened, a few restaurants, and students were less and less inclined to take their meals at one place. Foister. His was the first place to sell photographic supplies, develop your films, and frame your pictures. May there always be a Foister. Danziger came in much later, and has told his own story in his book, Papa D. Everyone loved him, and his Viennese cakes and coffee, which you could sip all day, at a little round table, without having to buy more than one cup. Indeed, Billy Hunt, a botanist, landscapist, one of the landed gentry who gave so generously to the botanical garden of his creating, kept a typewriter on a corner table at Danziger's, and used that spot as his office. But before the advent of the morning coffee break, there was Eubank's drugstore, where ladies met for a Coke and a gossip. Mr. Eubank's was an institution, a pillar of the Methodist Church, a strict teetotaler. One time, when Harriet Berry was a customer, she heard him laying it on about the evils of drink. "Mr. Eubanks," she said, "look at the bottles on your shelves. Don't you know that Lydia E. Pinkham's vegetable compound is more than 20% alcohol?" For once, Mr. Eubanks was silenced. He was the town's chief dispenser of prescriptions, and his pharmacist was Carl Durham, who later was persuaded to run for Congress, and most ably represented this district in the House for many years. Mr. Laycock's shoe repair shop was a prime necessity, and eventually there were two, one owned by his son, who, with his black helper, could repair all the shoes brought to him, overnight. When he gave you a ticket to present the next morning, your shoes were ready. Jack Andrews and Mr. Berman both carried general merchandise ranging over a wide field, from pins and needles to complete outfits. Some of the Berman stock was on the second floor, reached by a long staircase. I once tried to persuade him to put in an escalator, dwelling on the advertising possibilities of having the first escalator in town, but he was not a bit interested. Some shade trees grew at the edge of the sidewalk in front of his store, which, according to Mr. Berman's way of thinking, prevented passers-by from seeing his sign. He asked permission to cut them down from a town committee headed by W.C. Coker, and was told no. But this did not stop him. One morning, when Franklin Street came to life, the trees were gone. The town was similarly despoiled by the Deke, that's the D.K.E., fraternity. Forbidden to remove the trees growing in front of their not particularly handsome fraternity house, they too simply removed them overnight. In the early 30s, two young brothers, Milton and Maurice Julian, arrived from a suburb of Boston to enter the freshman class, and came to see me because the principal of their school, Miss Florence Ledbetter, had known my father when attending the Harvard summer school, and she told them to look me up. They said they had come to North Carolina because a relative of theirs lived in the state, and under his sponsorship they would not have to pay out-of-state tuition. I followed their progress with interest, seeing them advance in the business world from renting bicycles to establishing the exclusive men's clothing stores, which now bear their names. When I had cause to buy masculine attire, I went to Varley's, because I could count on his waiting on me and helping me in my selections. When did the Davises first open their university florist and gift shop? It seems to me they've always been here, ready to offer beautiful flowers and plants, and make up some of the loveliest arrangements I've ever seen. For years they had a standing order to provide flowers to decorate the Carolina Inn. I hope they still carry this on. The Pick, as we called the Pickwick Movie House, showed some of the best, certainly most amusing, moving pictures ever to be made. There we saw Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd, Andy Hardy with Mickey Rooney, as well as Norma Shearer, the Beery Brothers, Joan Crawford, Mary Pickford, and Doug. It was the golden age of the movies, even if it did lack color and special music. Music. We had Pickwick Mabel, now Mrs. V.A. Hill, whose piano playing was more than adequate, as she watched the screen, ready to suggest comedy or tragedy, and when the picture broke down entirely, threw herself into the breach with music, music, music. There were two evening shows, one early, one late, with the more sedate folk going late, while the students who patronized the first entered the theater with coats held over their heads to escape the hail of peanuts with which all were pelted. Later, Mr. Carrington Smith opened a second movie house, the Carolina, and patrons had their choice of several types of shows. There were two markets in the Columbia-Henderson Street block. One, owned by C.W. Shields, was the last to go, the last to which patrons to the east could walk and still manage to carry their unwieldy bags home. The other was the Model Market, owned by the Fowler brothers, who later built the unique Fowlers, still the standby of many old and new Chapel Hillians. It carried luxury items, some by request, from Thomas's English muffins to a minced octopus hors d'oeuvre. The boyish-looking Vance Hogan was the manager, and Sam Taylor in charge of meat, to whom you applied for a fresh Thanksgiving turkey, while Messrs. Boyd and King presided over vegetables and fruit. I was greatly flattered when one of them asked me the name of the perfume I used. He liked it and wanted to give some to his wife. It was Estee Lauder's Youth Dew. Leroy Merritt went from Model Market to Fowler's to the management, with his wife Aggie, of the Pines restaurant. When butter was scarce during World War II, he resented the buyers who came in just for that, and squirreled it away for the regular customers. He would nod to me, mysteriously, and slip me a package containing two sticks. I wanted to enter into the game, and fortunately owned a small stock of nylon stockings through a family textile connection. I beckoned him to the end of the counter, passed a small bundle into his hand, and in my best conspiratorial manner whispered, "For your wife." Due to a printing or binding error, the next four pages of the book are missing, so the Franklin Street Shops chapter comes to an early end. The Wallace Caldwells. It's difficult to try to write about my dear friends, Wallace and Harriet Caldwell, whom I still miss, but whose children carry on our friendship. They came to Chapel Hill in 1918 from New York State, Cornell and Bernard educated, with two small sons whom they had recently taken to Greece, Egypt, and neighboring countries, pursuing Wallace's special field in ancient history. It was about the time of the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb, and how enthusiastic they were over the treasures then revealed. Harriet was such a sweet and gentle woman that you had to know her a while before realizing how capable and efficient she was. Having belonged to the Pi Beta Phi sorority at Bernard, she had a great deal to do with helping the new chapter at Chapel Hill, which was just being organized. She was also active in our American Association of University Women, and suggested one of the ways in which we raised our contribution to the National Scholarship Fund, the May Morning Breakfasts. In the spring, when strawberries were ripe, the Episcopal Church allowed us to use their premises for this outdoor breakfast of waffles, coffee, and berries, and every available electric outlet would be in use by alumni from all over the eastern coast, turning out popular waffles. At first, UNC alumni were not admitted to membership, for the National Association had both academic and administrative rules, not accepting an institution unless it employed a certain number of women in teaching and administrative positions. In this way, our national branch was very helpful to Chapel Hill, since alumni could put pressure on the administration to advance the standing of women. At first, the Caldwells lived in a very old home, which was later torn down to make way for Spencer Hall. The dining room floor had a perceptible slope, and some of the doors did not quite fit. At one of the AAUW meetings, which at first were held in members' homes, we were disturbed by eerie wheezes which turned out to be snores from the Caldwells' ancient dog, Bozo. Wallace was the rare sort of teacher who made friends with his students. They would consult him on all their problems, both academic and personal, and he welcomed, at his home, informal sit-on-the-floor gatherings. We were amused when one time Wallace was asked if it was true that Catherine Batts, Pi Beta Phi member, leading playmaker actor, was engaged. He said solemnly, "I am sworn to secrecy." In 1923, I went abroad for a few weeks, and the Caldwells were most helpful in giving me all sorts of advice, what to see and what to avoid. There was a good pension on the Rue des Fleurus, Gertrude Stein's Street. Or, if a hotel was preferred, there was the Montalembert, also on the left bank, which I found a far more interesting quarter than the fashionable right. They saw me off in New York, on the little HMS Orbita, even providing me with large lemon drops to ward off a queasy stomach, and introductions to two fellow passengers, bachelor professors from Columbia. I will have to say that these were non-productive of any romance, for they were of the confirmed variety, and I spent no time working on them. Harriet and Wallace always wanted to build their own home in Chapel Hill, but their love of travel prevailed. In 1931, they again went to Europe, returning in 1932, when we were in the depths of the Depression, with all salaries cut back, and the birth of their daughter, Martha Bell, imminent. Well, Martha Bell is now a Ph.D., and recently lectured at Chapel Hill. Ted, who learned all about electronics and building airplanes after winning his letter on the UNC football team, has just retired with his wife, Katrina, to the place where they first met, while Bob, with degrees from Cornell and Johns Hopkins, entered the consular service, to the great benefit of both himself and his friends, for he found therein a charming wife who is just as hospitable as he is in showing the sights to friends, giving me 4 delightful days in Dublin in 1950, and 4 more in Copenhagen a few years later. I hope they too will retire to Chapel Hill some day, where they will still find friends of the 20s to greet them.
Let's have an old-fashioned talk.
We will walk any place you choose to.
Mrs. Didlake. In 1918 to 19, war years in which the university was chiefly given over to the Student Army Training Corps, or SATC, to which all eligible students aged 18 or over belonged, many people came and went, among whom were the Didlakes. He was a quiet lawyer who does not figure in this anecdote. His wife was very animated and voluble. They had a room at Dr. Bell's, a professor in the chemistry department, and took their meals with Mrs. Klutz. I barely knew them, but Mrs. Didlake selected me to confide that Mrs. Bell had invited her to a tea she was giving that afternoon, but Mrs. Didlake did not know whether or not to go, having just come to town and therefore ignorant of Mrs. Bell's social standing in the community. She had solved this knotty problem by deciding to go out earlier and pay some calls, then to drop in casually on Mrs. Bell's party. In that way, she thought, she would preserve her own social status without too greatly committing herself. Stein and Toklas. In the early 1930s, when the United States was in the depths of the Great Depression, I was elected president of our local chapter of the American Association of University Women. We were all so hard up that it was difficult to scrape up the $3 for dues, and anything extra for the fellowship fund seemed out of the question. In this dilemma, Agatha Adams, Mrs. N. B., came up with a suggestion. She had heard that Gertrude Stein was to speak at her college in Virginia. Perhaps we could induce her to repeat her talk in Chapel Hill. Letters were written, and she agreed to come, stipulating that her audience must not be more than 300 people, which severely limited us, for in spite of hard times, we could have sold many more tickets in Chapel Hill, Durham, and Raleigh. There was a great curiosity about the lady who had said, "A rose is a rose is a rose." Both the English department and the AAUW sponsored her, and we chose Girard Hall as the most suitable auditorium. One person who was greatly excited about her coming was Milton Abernethy, the proprietor of a unique bookshop on Franklin Street, where he both sold and rented books, not seeming to care whether the customers paid for them or not. He looked me up in the library to make sure that Gertrude Stein was really coming. She and her friend and companion, Alice B. Toklas, were installed in a suite at the Carolina Inn, and Susan Akers, head of our library school and AAUW treasurer, and I called at once to pay our respects. We were paired off, Miss Toklas, a vivacious, homely woman, talking to me. And what was her first topic of conversation? She wanted to know about Milton Abernethy. It seems that she had published one of Miss Stein's books, and had filled an order from the Abernethy bookshop, but never been able to collect a penny in payment. Evidently his business procedures were slack in both directions. I could at least assure her that he and his shop existed, but whether she looked him up or not, and extracted payment, I've never known. I was told later that she and Miss Stein had thought we were the bearers of her honorarium, so we must have disappointed them. When the time for the lecture arrived, Gertrude Stein took her place in front of the platform, refusing to mount it and stand behind the lectern. She was a short, dumpy figure clad in a dark skirt with very colored overblouse, it might have been called peasant, with gray hair cut close to her head. She commanded the close attention of her audience, but I'm sorry to admit that I do not remember a thing that she said. She had not been talking much more than a half an hour when someone in the balcony got up and went out. Miss Stein glanced up and shortly brought her talk to a close. I'm glad to say that she was taken over to the student union, where students clustered around her, sitting on the floor, asking questions. She seemed to enjoy this. In a recent book about her, she is quoted as speaking kindly of the visit. Professor William Olson used to entertain his closest friends with a takeoff of Gertrude Stein, said to be hilarious. I'm sorry to say I never had a chance to hear it. Oh, yes, our AAUW was able to make a generous contribution to the Fellowship Fund. The Oliver Towleses. Dr. Towles was a professor in the French department, living with Dean McGee when I came to Chapel Hill. We were dancing together at a gay party when I felt emboldened and in the right spirit to recite the French poem about Mr. Crow perched in the top of a tree, holding a piece of cheese in his beak, and how the wily fox diddled him out of it. My accent was excruciating, but my partner was also in an uplifted mood and praised my French highly. There is a lapse of time to the summer of 1923 when I was in Paris with the Kent Browns, and we learned that Oliver Towles and his French bride were there too, so it seemed fitting for us to invite them to join us in a champagne toast to the newlyweds on Montmartre. We would be the first Chapel Hillians for Dominique to meet. To be frank, she was no beauty, but extremely well-educated, not in languages, but in more abstruse fields. To my dismay, Dr. Towles, who she called Oliver, introduced me, on the basis of Maître Corbeau, the poem, as able to talk in her language. However, Kent could talk to her. We had some champagne, and the party was proceeding merrily until our host poured a third round into the groom's champagne glass. Evidently, this was too much for the bride. She leaned across the host, lifted up Oliver's glass, and put it beyond his reach. This, in the presence of his friends, whom she had just met. It was symbolic of the future. And she did not like Chapel Hill. She once said to me, when her English was picking up, "Here the women stand in one part of the room, the men in another. In France it is not so." I am sure she was much happier when Oliver accepted a call to New York University, and they moved to New York. Someone reported having seen her pushing a baby carriage in Central Park, but beyond that, we heard no more of them. Jury duty in Hillsborough. When I was summoned to do jury duty in Hillsborough, I was told by friends to give some excuse. You can easily get off. Women don't have to serve. But I wanted to serve, knowing nothing about such proceedings and desirous of finding out. It met in the old courthouse in Hillsborough, the handsome old building planned by Captain John Barry and now used as a museum. It proved to be rather primitive inside, with plain furniture, the judge sitting at a table behind a wooden rail, with witnesses and spectators in raised rows of seats facing him. I don't remember about spittoons, but when I first visited the state capitol at Raleigh, there were large ones scattered around, with a sign above them, "If you spit at home, spit here. We want you to feel perfectly at home." Jurymen were called. A few presented valid excuses and were dismissed, leaving two university faculty members and other miscellaneous men, some of them elderly. I was the only woman. Later, I learned that we would be paid $3 a day. We were seated in rows to the right of the judge, facing him and the disputants, side to the audience. In this court, only the simplest local cases were tried, the judge rendering his decision on evidence presented by plaintiff and accuser, without intervening lawyers. The judge appeared thoroughly at home in his job, a capable and experienced man. First to be called were the parties wanting a divorce, such cases not requiring a jury. All that was needed was to bring a witness who could state that the couple had not lived together for 2 years. Then the divorce was automatically granted. One divergent case involved a rather good-looking woman who claimed she had not received the regular payments due in support of her out-of-wedlock child. The child's father was a most unattractive specimen of a man, with a cast in one eye and a bald spot. You had to wonder, surely the woman could have done better. They talked to the judge in low tones, and something must have been settled, as the couple left the courtroom. The actual cases were fairly simple, several involving somebody throwing a rock at somebody. Usually these were black people. The jury would listen to both sides and then go into an adjoining room to consider their verdict. A small water closet opened into this room, and if any juryman, or woman, wanted to use it, he went right ahead. Dr. Stephen Emery, professor of philosophy, was our foreman. He would lead a discussion of each case, and then go down the line of jurymen, seated on a long bench against the wall, who responded, guilty or not guilty. There was little disagreement in most of the cases, but in one the verdict was unanimous, except for one rosy-cheeked old man, who sat there smiling benevolently on all of us. I recognized him as the father of two brothers who worked in our model market. Mr. Emery went up to him, trying to find out why he differed from the others. It then developed that he was quite deaf and thought he had been agreeing with us. Another case involved a man with a small plane who maddened his neighbor by persistently flying over the neighbor's land. The latter carried the case to court, where the judge talked to them and brought about some sort of a settlement without the jury having to take action. I rode over each day with the Chapel Hillians, and we had a pleasant lunch together at a little Hillsboro restaurant. Luckily, the cases on docket were completed in 3 days, which was quite enough to acquaint me with the procedures of such a court. The Jesse Mebbins. Pearl and Jesse Mebbin had been a well-to-do couple whose property consisted chiefly of land in the country club region of Greensboro, but in the Great Depression they lost their land. Jesse took a salesman's job traveling for a textile company and moved his company to Chapel Hill in order to put the children through college as inexpensively as possible. There were three, Anne, Esther, and Robert, and a widowed sister-in-law, Mrs. Cummings Mebbin, whose income had likewise been wiped out, came with her two boys to live with them. They rented the Vernon Howell place, and it became the center for a group of jolly young folks, also a home away from home for Charles Mangum next door. They made him welcome with open arms, and he thrived in an atmosphere of unceasing hospitality, games, and congenial youth. The Mebbins had suffered great financial losses. Their way of life was totally changed, but you would never have known it by any murmur from the parents. They maintained an atmosphere of warmth and love, and if they ever uttered a complaint, their friends never heard it. Here is a story Mrs. Mebbin told on herself. At a football game, she was giving vent to anxious cries about her son on the playing field, until finally a lady sitting in front of her turned around and asked sympathetically, "What position is your son playing?" Mrs. Mebbin shamefacedly had to admit, "He is the water boy." We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.